dial 763 to the 3500.
WCBM FM Ann Arbor.
Emma, reading in between the lines.
Every day you hit my phone up. Every time
you hit my phone up,
it makes my heart jump. I want you to say it, baby.
It makes my heart jump.
Say it like you mean it. It's right there on the tip of your tongue.
Hit my phone up.
And I can feel it. And I like it, baby. Don't you stop.
Don't stop what you're doing, baby.
You know I like it. You stretch it out.
You know I like it.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Living Writers Show. I'm Amanda Yulee, your host for today, and we are in the studio here in Ann Arbor on Wednesday, December 19th with Samantha Irby. Hello, Samantha.
Hi, Amanda.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
We just heard Robin, Between the Lines, and we are so glad that you're joining us today. I'm going to start by just telling our listeners a little bit about you before we have you tell us about your latest book. So Samantha Irby is the author of the book Meaty, and We Are Never Meeting in Real Life. And she's also the creator of the very popular blog, Bitches Gotta Eat. Yes?
Yes.
Anything you want to add to that abbreviated bio?
Talking about myself is maybe the most embarrassing thing I ever have to do.
You have 59 minutes remaining of just that. But
so I just want everyone to know that they won't be able to see it, but I will be molting beneath my clothes.
No one can see us.
So I write, for the most part, comedic essays. Whenever people ask you, like, what you write, it's always, I'm always like, you know, they're essays, but they're funny, because people hear essay and think, like, smart. Or school, and I have to disabuse them of that notion immediately. I'm like, no, not smart.
Oh,
don't
smart.
Worry.
I'm going to argue with you on that one. Your essays are very smart. School, academic.
Right.
Yes, I'm with you there.
Not academic, but funny, accessible. Someone told me, like, sent me an email the other day that said, thanks for being so accessible.
Oh.
And I don't really know what that means other than, like, I just kind of give everyone everything on the page. I mean, nobody gives everything, so like 95% of everything. so I guess that is my writing, 95% of my whole self on the page with jokes sprinkled in between. And
yes.
I might be the last writer on the planet who still has a blog that they update.
Blogspot.
Semi-regularly. Yes. Yeah. I still have a Blogspot. I haven't even switched over to like a real website. I still let Google host my blog because I'm
lazy.
Website.
That's all right.
Is it? Okay.
You're
all
fine.
Right.
How long have you run the blog?
I first started it in 2008. So it's had a couple of forms before now.
Mm-hmm.
I started the blog on MySpace. I don't know if anyone will remember what MySpace is, but MySpace used to have this feature where you could have like a blog that was, I think it was like linked at the bottom of your profile, and it was free. It was super simple. Like, it didn't look fancy. I mean, nothing on MySpace really looked fancy.
Yeah, I'm picturing MySpace right
but
now.
But I started the blog because I met this dude who was like, oh, you're a writer, where can I see your writing? And at the time, the answer was nowhere, because I wasn't really a writer. I'd written a bunch of like short stories in high school and like had a couple journals, but I was like, let me figure out where you can see it. So then I started a blog on my MySpace to impress one person.
Okay.
And he was impressed.
Yeah.
And we dated.
MySpace is impressive.
I mean, you know, it wasn't hard. I should say, for a person without a band, it's pretty hard. It's pretty easy to like look cool on MySpace. There were lots of bands on MySpace.
But it worked. You're writing Lord the
Man. Yeah. We dated. It was terrible.
Okay.
And so then when it was over, I was like, well, I'm done with this. It's, you know, it served its purpose. And then my friend Laura was like, dude, a lot of people read it. And you could see, it's not really analytics, but you could see like how many people were reading your blog. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, this is definitely like outside my top eight. Like this has a little reach. And so then MySpace ended, like everybody went to Facebook and I was like, well, okay, the universe does not want me to do this blog anymore.
Yeah.
And she was like, you know, you could like go on the internet and figure out how to start a blog. So I had to Google, how do you start a blog? And like Blogger's the first thing that came up. And so I just started it. And at first, I didn't know what it was going to be. Like, I just wrote about like what I was watching on TV. Mm-hmm. Just really like I just wanted to make my friends laugh and sort of have like a diary outlet. And then it started like to gain some traction. And I was like, okay, I'm going to keep doing this. And I kind of just started writing about everything and like people responded to it. And so
when you say everything, your life or everything in the world that you were observing?
Well, my life mostly, because one, I sort of feel like, I don't know, I don't have an elegant way to say this, but I feel like you shouldn't really comment on like social or political things unless you have some education to back it up. And so like I have many uneducated opinions, but I don't know that I need them on the internet for the rest of time. Yeah. So I was like, I'm gonna talk about what I know best, which at the time was myself and like dating. And things that my friends were doing, like going out all the time. So I kept it like pretty close. And like occasionally I would sprinkle in some like, you know, a little like social commentary. But not a whole lot.
Well, that's like MFA program advice, write what you know. It's like you're just doing exactly the formal thing.
Yeah.
You're supposed to
Am I allowed to say I have like an MFA from the School of Hard Knocks or something?
You are.
Okay. All right. People will, I mean, people will believe it at this point. I think I have enough of a platform to be convincing, but I don't know. People kept reading it and kept like talking to me about it. And so I kept doing it. And then I started performing. So Chicago has what we call the live lit community, which is essentially like shows that are like The Moth, and all different types of them. They're all over the place. And I started performing at a couple of these shows. And really, it was so easy. You just come in. I would, like, print something off my blog, come in, read it in front of a bar full of, you know, drunk people, and then go home. And it was, like, easy. It was a way to, like, see how my words were resonating with real people. And I kind of started building a name for myself in the Live Lit community, along with having the blog, and that just kind of turned into a monster, I guess. And then my first book came out in 2013 on a little indie press in Chicago. And I really, people will ask, like, how did you get to do a book? And the real answer is I was performing in bars and stuff. And I met these guys who run
Curbside Splendor. Right?
Yeah. And they were like, you want to do a book? And I immediately was like, no, it's so much work. It it seems like so much of a commitment. I'm not going to make any money. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. And so I was like, get out of here. And like, you know, for like years, I would run into them randomly because they go to all the shows and Chicago is really like the smallest big city on earth. Yeah. Although everyone in every big city says that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Chicago really is like, you turn around and like, there is someone you know. And so I kept running into them until finally I was just like, okay, I'll do it. If you let me just do whatever I want, I'll do it. And they said yes. Mm-hmm. They let me put a chicken on the cover.
Oh, good.
And
I haven't seen that cover. I'm looking at other animals on your books right
now. I'll send you a copy of the original. And And then I was like, well, I guess I'm really a writer now. That is the very long, like, how did I get started? That's my long origin story.
There were so many good things about what you just said. And what I want to come back to in a minute is how you kind of self-identified as a writer, maybe before you were or as mm-hmm. you were becoming one.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
First, I want to say, this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and it's the Living Writers Show. We have Samantha Irby with us in the studio, and I'm so glad. Samantha is author most recently of We Are Never Meeting in Real Life, her collection of essays.
Yeah. It's good. Go get it.
Yeah, go get it. It's yellow as well.
It has a cat on it.
A wet cat?
A wet cat. I did not get to choose. You know, like when you graduate to like the big guys, mm-hmm. they sort of tell you what your book is going to look like. But they sent this to me and I was like, I mean, it's pretty on brand for me. Like the cat looks kind of mangy and angry, which is, I think, my general, you know, that's the way I present to the world is pretty mangy and angry. So
I think I just am learning about the first book cover and I'm fascinated that it's all animals. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, I don't know why we did the first one. Yes, I do. When I was little, my dad used to call me Chicken.
Oh.
And I thought that would be like a hilarious homage to have like a kind of angry chicken on the cover. And because it's called Meaty, but it's not really about meat, which I got a few complaints. I've gotten a few weird emails from people who, after the first edition, I got an email from this woman. Well, you never know who anyone is, right, when they email you out of the blue.
Know.
But she said that she was a middle-aged woman and she got my book from the library and she thought it was going to be about farming and she was very disappointed to discover that it was about my butt. And I was like, well, sorry, Grandma, you should have flipped it over.
Yeah.
Read the back. It's pretty clear.
It's not about farming.
No, I mean, maybe it's about where the food ends up once it's run its course, but.
So funny. So would you like to kind of introduce this book for us? I mean,
yes.
Maybe you have a little bit in talking about your journey as a writer, but I think for those of our listeners who have not yet read We Are Never Meeting in Real Life,
so
you can tell us more.
It's basically about my sort of not coming of age. It's too old to be coming of age, but basically, like, it's about my mid to late 30s and at that point, I had been running an animal hospital for a long time and kind of writing on the side, dealing with Crohn's disease and dealing with sort of the shifting landscape of like my romantic life. Like I went from a relationship with a man to a period of celibacy and then I ended up getting married to a woman. So we sort of cover the course of those things.
The personal life.
Yeah. It's basically like all of the changes that you could go through. There's a little bit about dealing with depression and mm-hmm. anxiety, like a cornucopia of mid-30s crises.
Don't you think coming-of-age books can happen anytime? It's boring if they're all about 16-year-olds, right?
I do, but then there's the part of me that feels like immature wishes that I weren't coming of age in my mid-30s. Like, so many things happen that just make me wish that I always think, shouldn't I have gone through this already? Shouldn't I have fixed this already? And basically, I guess that's what the book is grappling with, all these things I should have fixed but have not.
I don't think everybody's fixed by 40.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but it's,
we like to believe that.
Yes. And maybe, so part of my work has always been about, both my parents died when I was 18. Mm-hmm. So part of it has been just about like what it's like to sort of go through life without, not an anchor, but you know, I never had an example of people who I took all my cues for how adults should be from, like, my friends' parents and television. So not understanding what it is to be an adult, I think is partially because, you know, I didn't have a mom who I could call who would say, listen, I had no idea what a mortgage was when I was 32, you know, so then I was putting it together myself and was like, man, everybody seems to be advancing past me. What is my problem?
Well, your books are a really fascinating way that you show how you work that stuff out. And I think it's very relatable.
Yeah.
Because I contend not everybody has it figured out by 30 or 40.
Yeah. Now I know. Now that I am being honest about not having it figured out and demanding that honesty from other people.
Yeah.
Now I'm 100% clear that no one
Ever, maybe.
But at the beginning of the journey, I was like, why am I so far behind? Like, why am I not, why don't I have what I'm supposed to have? And now I know that there's no supposed to have. There's just what you got and what
and
you can
you
do
are.
With it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break and hear another one of the songs that you chose for our hour. We'll hear Xavier Omar and If This Is Love. Do you want to say why you chose that song? Do you have any?
It is, I really love a, like, slow jam, and it's, this is my, like, slow jam of the year.
Let's hear
it's
it.
It's so good.
The Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Amanda Yulee, your host for today. Our wonderful engineer, I should say, is Frank Yulee across the window there. And I'm sitting across from Samantha Irby, who is author of Meaty and We Are Never Meeting in Real Life and Bitches Gotta Eat, the blog. And other things, too.
Yeah.
Other stuff.
I have a few articles. I've been in the New York Times a couple times.
That's exciting.
All that stuff is so embarrassing.
It's not embarrassing.
It listing my resume is like my least favorite.
Okay.
Although I suppose if somebody forgot it, I'd be like,
excuse me.
Remember that time I was in the New York Times though? Like three times, remember?
No, I should forget. So you said something before, which I loved, which was about the time in your life when you had written things, mm-hmm. and you maybe wrote privately, but you weren't a published writer, mm-hmm. And so you turned to MySpace. But you, in this interaction in person, you called yourself a writer. And I think I've done a lot of work with youth writing, with 826 Network, mm-hmm. and some other things. And so I find it really important for young people and any kind of emerging writer to be able to take that on, right? Define yourself mm-hmm. as a writer, and that's like a big leap. Especially for some kids.
It's hard.
Who aren't used to it. So
yeah.
How did you made that leap in your 20s?
Yeah, I think I said it to get things. Like, obviously, I said it to
self-interestedly
woo this person. And then if you keep saying it, it just kind of sticks. I think until I had something to show for it, I felt like I couldn't call myself a writer. And even like when the thing I had to show for it was a blog on the internet that's free, it felt a little like I was cheating to call myself a writer. And then when my first book was published the first time, I was like, okay, now I can say that I'm a writer because I have a book. But even then, I would qualify it and be like, well, it's on a small press and they let me do it because they know me, you know. So now I think I, with two books, I feel...
Viking?
Yeah, it's vintage. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I had never heard of... I mean, what is anything before you're, like, working with them, right? Uh-huh. I didn't know publishers. Even now, I'm like, who? So, like, before, you know, before it's really real, it didn't feel like something I could say. Especially because... And I really want to change this for myself and for other people, but I always felt like delegitimized because I wrote funny stuff. Because really, people will, like, when you tell them you write jokes, everyone's like, oh, I could do that. Oh, you're funny? I could do that.
Really?
They don't ever think they can do what Ta-Nehisi Coates does, but when I'm like, oh, here's a thing I wrote about diarrhea, people are like, oh, that doesn't take any skill. I can do that. And I'm like, well, actually... First, you have to survive the diarrhea, and then you have to make it funny. But, yeah, calling myself a writer was really hard, because when you say it to people, the next question is, what have you written? Mm-hmm. And if you don't have an answer to that question, it feels like it's not, like that's not who you are.
Yeah.
So I still have to catch myself from, like, saying, oh, I wrote a book, but they're jokes. Or I wrote a book, but it's just essays. You know, I still have to stop myself from doing that.
I think it's interesting that people say, or people can perceive that it's easy to write funny.
Oh, all the time.
It's not.
I always struggle, not struggle, that makes it sound more dramatic than it is, but when I'm writing, I'm always double checking and sending things to people like, this made me laugh, but is it funny to you? Like, is this out of context thing that I've written? Like, did you chuckle when I sent that to you? But there are so many overconfident people have sent me, like, clips of their things or essays they've written or things they've written and been like, you know, I'm very similar to you. My agent gets things all the time that are queries from people who are like, you rep Samantha Irby. This is very similar to her stuff. Yeah. And then I read it and I'm like, is that how my work appears to people? Because that's terrible. So it does happen, like, when people, you know, people just think, oh, it's easy. Everybody, you're just an amusing person who sat down and wrote this thing that happened to make me laugh. And it's like, oh, maybe, but also it does take skill to make other people laugh, especially at things that aren't really that funny, which is a lot of what I do, is trying to take something that's terrible and squeeze the jokes out of it.
Well, that's the next thing I was going to ask you about is, I mean, some people would think diarrhea is funny just on its own, but not necessarily.
Yeah.
But then you've written about things that I can imagine were incredibly painful personally.
Yeah.
And you still made me laugh on some of them.
I try.
So how does that work?
I think I usually don't write about anything, a thing that's painful, until I have enough distance from it emotionally to pick the funny parts out. Like, some things are sad and funny when they're happening. Like, at my mom's funeral, I have three sisters. We had the funeral at this church that my sister went to, but not all of us did. And so the minister was like, made a big show of naming all of my mom's children, but he kept messing up the names. And to some people, that's like tragic and terrible, but I couldn't stop laughing. It was so funny to me. And so a thing like that in the moment, I was like, okay, this is some levity that we need. This is a terrible situation. And look at our mom in that casket. But also, he cannot get my sister's name right. And it's like Carol. It's not even a hard
it's
name.
It's like a tough one.
Yeah, we don't have difficult names. So some things are immediately funny. And other things, if I just give myself a week, a month, you know, a year, a few years, I'm like, okay, that was really painful. But like that time you got dumped was really horrible. Uh-huh. And it was in public. But dude was wearing boat shoes, and let's make fun of that part, you know? And then it becomes easier to write about a thing and make it funny as if I can, because there's always some absurd little nugget at some point in the story that I can pull out and turn a sad piece into maybe less sad.
Yeah.
Not always hilarious. Like writing about my parents dying wasn't always, you know, those pieces aren't really like slap yourself on the knee slappers. That's the phrase.
Knee slappers.
They aren't really knee slappers, but there are parts of them that, you know, lighten up the mood a little bit.
But you weren't feeling those. You weren't viewing it through a humorous lens when it was happening, I'm guessing.
No, no. I mean, and this is a thing that people who do comedy, I think, struggle with, is that everyone thinks you're a clown all the time. And I definitely am not. I mean, that really is an impetus for me, or has been an impetus for me, to sort of write about mental illness and some other things that are less funny. Because you do run up against people who, if they don't think they can do what you do, they think you're just like a joke monkey who will make them laugh on command. And I'm not really that either. So I don't always, you know, I don't walk up to every situation like, can't wait for this to bowl me over. But I can experience a thing, get on the other side of it, and be like, okay, that was horrible, but also here's the funny part.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you ever feel, maybe this is a big question, but do you ever feel any regret for things that you've shared in writing? I mean, I think about the scene that I read about maintenance man in your mother's apartment.
Oh, yeah.
And you had a difficult, probably very traumatic experience with your parents' deaths. Like some of the things that I've read, you've written about, I wonder if you, how you feel about those being forever out there.
So I think there are things, I should say first that there are things that I probably either haven't written about or haven't written about extensively that I keep the real stuff like close to.
You said 95% at the beginning.
Yeah, that 5% I do protect. Yeah. The 95%, I mean, so when working on a book, and not to really get into the nuts and bolts of it, because I'm sure people can imagine what that is like, when you're working like with an editor, you know, I mean, when it takes like a year for what you've written to become a book that's out in the world, once I've gone through it with several, you know, with my editor, with, you know, sort of faceless copy editors in New York that I never get to talk to, but who argue with me in the margins, that at any point, if something felt too tough, like during that process, I could be like, let's pull that out because it's too much. So once it's sort of been, you know, the scab's been picked at by several people, it's okay for it to be out in the world. I don't have any real regrets. Anything I think might be tricky or hurtful to someone else, I usually clear that with the person. That's the only thing I think I would ever regret, is if I said something about someone whose opinion I cared about, because there's some people I don't care. Some people who burn me, yeah. Well, I'm like, all right, I'm going to burn you too. And it, you know, let's scorch the earth together. But if anyone were to come to me recognizing themselves and been like, listen, we could have worked this out a different way, or this is a thing that I wish you would have brought to me, then I would feel bad. But all of the people who I've written about, who I care about, I usually send them the piece first. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how do you feel about this? There's a piece in We're Never Meeting in Real Life called A Blues for Fred, which is about this tumultuous relationship I had with my last boyfriend. And I sent it to him, and it was really tough because it's a long essay. I'm very fond of it. I feel like mm-hmm. I did good work. I feel like it's an equal mixture of funny and sad. And I felt like it could do a lot of good being in the world, you know, like a lot of people could relate to yeah. it. And I sent it to him when I was done. And I basically was like, if you say that you don't want this in the world, because it uses his real name, I won't put it in the book. And that... it was a gamble, because if he had said no, then I would lose this like amazing thing that I felt like so strongly about. But he wrote back and said that it was fine. So I put it in. So I don't regret anything, but I think mostly it's because I'm careful to avoid,
yeah.
you know, I think we're all, at least to some degree, the kind of people who stay up at night haunted by our past mistakes. And I would like for future me not to hate current me,
yeah.
Yeah. you know, because I'm up at two in the morning, like wringing my hands over something that I knew I shouldn't have done, but I did. So I'm pretty careful about things that are going to be in the permanent
record.
Well,
you're careful, but you're brave too. It's incredibly brave to put yourself and some least elegant moments, maybe.
For me, there have been no drawbacks. Not yet. It's the only, I shouldn't say the only, but the overwhelming response I get from people is like gratitude.
Yeah.
You know, people who see themselves in things I've said. I get a lot of people with chronic illness who email or like message me on Instagram or whatever and say like, thanks for talking about what it's like to sort of walk around with a silent disease all the time. Mm. So all of that stuff. And I can't stress hard enough that the freedom from being honest is like, I just don't have to hide many things.
That's a good point.
And it's very freeing. You know what I mean? Like, if I ever was gonna, you know, meet someone who like didn't know what I look like, because like every picture of me had been like the slim piece of profile, you know, I don't ever have to do that. I'm like, listen, you know what it is. You know what I look like. You know what I got going. You know that when I excuse myself that I'm going to be in the bathroom for half an hour because you know I have this gut disease. It's like, it's very freeing.
It's out there.
Yeah, to have people know.
We're talking to Samantha Irby today on the Living Writer Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. We're going to hear a song from The National for a quick break, and then we'll be back. I hope you'll read something for us, and I have so many more questions for you.
Okay.
Here's The National.
Today, you were far away, and I didn't ask you why. I
we're back. I'm Amanda Yulee here with the Living Writer Show. We're speaking with Samantha Irby, who I believe is going to read a little something from her latest collection of essays. What have you got?
So this is from We're Never Meeting in Real Life. And I have a whole section about working out and exercise and dieting. And so I'm going to read a little bit from that piece. And it's about my obsession with Zumba.
Okay.
Okay. And for those of you who don't, well, you should know what Zumba is. Come on. But you'll find out in a second if you don't know what that word means. Ditch the workout and join the party, the official website shouted at my eyeballs. Zumba is the only Latin-inspired dance fitness program that blends red-hot international music and contagious steps to form a fitness party that is downright addictive. I am suspicious of words like addictive and contagious, and I immediately blanched while clicking through all the pictures of lean and toned soccer moms gyrating in crop tops and neon bicycle shorts, their perfect bodies beaded with sweat, their toothy, open-mouth grins screaming, "I am having the time of my young and conventionally attractive life." I am a negative person by nature, and I typically shy away from anything that requires me to be having visible fun. I like to do stuff that I can sit quietly in the back and enjoy, and I've spent my entire adult life perfecting a bored yet slightly amused and entertained facade. And I just don't understand being excited about exercise. It's like doing a cartwheel on your way to have a root canal. My face just doesn't light up at the prospect of abdominal isolations. Also, the pictures. Look at that instructor guy with his shirt off. I'm not trying to embarrass myself, tripping over my feet, doing watered-down salsa steps, while some red-hot international instructor rolls his eyes at me in disgust and bounces quarters off his ridiculously chiseled backside. The Sunday morning of my first class, I got up and put on socks and my old New Balances while remaining in my pajamas. I can't compete with these people doing a revolutionary new fitness concept while wearing bikini tops, so I decided it was in the best interest of my self-esteem to go to the opposite end of the clothing spectrum and just look like absolute trash. Because even if I busted my melon open while trying to cumbia to the beat, at least my stomach would be appropriately covered. I took 37 Aleve and a Norco and tried to inconspicuously stretch my Achilles on the train platform so it wouldn't snap in the middle of a routine. When I got to the gym, I paid the $15 drop-in fee and found my way up to the dance studio. I hovered nervously near the back of the gym, anxious for all the J-Lo lookalikes to start pouring in and making me feel bad about that container of Greek yogurt I'd eaten in the locker room. And then your mom came in, wearing booty shorts and the shirt she wears to wash the dishes, flanked on either side by your Aunt Judy and your recently retired fifth grade teacher. Her sewing circle showed up next, as did her crochet buddies, and all the ladies from book club, with the exception of Kathy, whose son had strep, so she decided to stay home with him. There's the woman who cuts your mom's hair, and Diane, who works part-time at Eileen Fisher in the mall. The school board ladies, the PTA, and the hockey moms came running in, too, clad in biker shorts and racer back tanks, with their hair pulled up in banana clips and scrunchies. I don't know what I had been so worried about. I thought this was for attractive young people, I wondered aloud to no one in particular. A lady down the way looked me up and down. Yeah, she said, eyeing my flabby triceps and pulling a protein bar from her fanny pack. Me too. The music started, and our teacher, a boisterous woman who was wearing a sports bra and a noisy coin skirt, whose constant jangling set my molars on fire, started shouting and dancing and pointing out people who sucked as we tried desperately to follow along. I was winded after the first song, and 20 minutes in, I told the woman struggling next to me to call an ambulance. I was sweating in the grossest possible way, sweat dripping from my hair into my eyelashes before rolling down my nose. Your mom is pretty good at Zumba, but thank goodness she ain't got no rhythm. The only thing that kept me from looking like a complete moron was my blackness, which kicked in right when I needed it most. I might not have gotten every single step, but at least I wasn't clapping on the one and the three. Despite the fact that I really did almost keel over and die, I was hooked. It is physically impossible for me to smile while skipping and jumping and fist pumping, but I loved it. Thumping loud music at 9:30 on a Sunday morning in a room full of wasps who were coming down off a Chardonnay bender. More, please. These ladies yelled and whooped and screamed for an hour. Then they toweled off and hopped in their Lexus SUVs to congregate over skinny lattes at the Starbucks two streets over. The minute that first class was finished, I vomited my right lung onto the locker room floor, then went downstairs and signed over half my paycheck to become an official member of the gym. It was fun. My heart rate was high enough to make me feel like an actual sentient human being. And, for your information, Ricky Martin made a lot of good dance music, so bite your hateful tongue. And it's lame knowing that I need the withering gaze of your hot-flashed, perimenopausal mother to get me to samba my way to maybe living past the age of 39. But admitting defeat is the first step, right? I live in fear of the day I go flying off a moving treadmill, but pretending I can bachata to Gloria Estefan for an hour is something I can do. Plus, your mom said she would bake me gluten-free cookies and give me the number to her masseuse next week. And that girl has a tight ass. I've been noticing.
Thank you, Samantha Irby.
You are welcome.
So you write, this is you. This is you yourself in Zumba, yes, writing about this. All of your essays are,
yeah,
you.
That was me at the Y in Evanston, Illinois on a Sunday morning.
Felt like
with
Evanston.
All my friends' moms.
I was picking up Evanston. So as someone who writes about yourself and your experiences, do you find that readers assume they know you? I mean, I know a few people who've written memoirs and things, and people
make assumptions. Yeah, they do. And I would counter that they do know me, or they know a part. Yeah. Like, that's for real me. Like sweating and with a side cramp, panting in the Y locker room, the same Y where I went to preschool and like know the people who work there. That is me. No one has ever gotten too like outrageous or like made an assumption that I was like, no, you got it wrong. Like, most people with decent reading comprehension, I think, have me pretty well pegged.
Is that okay with you? Do you like meeting people who are like, so the Zumba, I had the same,
Yes.
You like that?
It breaks down a wall that you would have to like spend hours actually talking to a person. I mean, it really is like selfish on my part. So I'm like, here's me.
Just read
it. Come back when you've learned it and talk to me about the parts that you can relate to. That's like a gross thing, but it's really great. Cause I don't have to explain myself. Like they know what they're getting. The only time it's come to like bite me is when people like really do love me or feel passionate or whatever, which I love. But then they're like, could you come do this thing? And I'm like, did you read the part about how I don't want to go anywhere? Because that includes whatever like PTA meeting you're inviting me to or whatever, like dinner you're asking me to go to. But that happens like pretty rarely. It's also like amazing to know that if I was like, I need some place to stay in whatever city, I could probably find someone who has read my stuff and trusts me enough to let me into their home.
But that, this is a totally one-sided situation. You don't know them. That's what...
I know, but I feel like so far, the only people have been like, nice.
You're so brave.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't go stay with someone. Okay. I want to stay in a hotel because I don't want anyone. I don't ever want to give anyone the behind the curtain, right? The like, this is what she ate while she was here, and this is how many hours she was alone in our guest room. Like, I never want to give anyone that, but I do want to know that I could.
I think you could. Yeah. But it sounds like it's not creepy for you to know that lots of people feel like they know you. They know about in the bedroom, they know your health, they know like all this stuff. It's
I love all of it. It doesn't, I mean, it has so far, I got to knock on some wood, it has proven to not be like a dangerous thing. Like no one has ever, I mean, mostly it's just people who are essentially like nice, sweet people who come to some pre-appointed thing I said I was gonna be at, and they like bring me things that they know I can't eat because if they've read, you know, I got a lot of restrictions, but like, so yeah, it doesn't creep me
out. You just have a lot of friends.
I love it. Yeah.
That's good.
I mean, obviously I have some sort of emotional deficit where I just am trying to fill some hole with strangers who like my jokes, but.
You got a lot of them. I like your jokes, so
it's helped. Right.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, you just read aloud for us, and your work has appeared lots of different ways, right? So you have the books, you have the blog, and you have or do perform live, Those are all different things, right?
Yes.
How do you toggle between those, and is it the same writing?
Like, what I just read to you just now was not written exactly that way in the book. You sort of have to cut. I like a run-on sentence. I love a lot of commas. I love a lot of, I just want a paragraph full of words. Like, I love a big run-on stream of consciousness kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Can't perform like that, mostly because I don't have the lung capacity to perform like that. So a lot of times when I read something from the book, I'll do some edits to make it, you know, I got to mark where I need to pause, where to get the laugh, where to, you know, where to do that. Things that I write that are just for the stage, like there's a show in Chicago called The Paper Machete that happens every Saturday at the Green Mill, and I'm a staff writer on the show. And it's, I have not performed in a while, but it's a weekly kind of rundown of the news. Chris Pyatt, who hosts it, gets tons of people, comics and writers and stuff to do their takes on the news. So when I do that show, I have to take a news thing, write about it in my way, make it funny. And I know it needs to be short. It has to have lots of punchlines. It has to, you know, so like there's a different way I write when I know I'm just going to perform. I tend to keep it really brief. Like, I don't like to be on stage for more than like 7 minutes.
You just trim it.
Yeah. Yeah. I cut like things that come from the book. I cut down because it's really, I love to perform, but really people like tune out 5 minutes in and people are like, okay, wrap
it
up. Yeah. So you really have to know. I think that's why I'm a good performer, is because I'm very conscious of the audience and what an audience wants. So it is a little different, but it's just a matter of like cutting things for
And what
time.
About the website?
So the blog is probably where I'm my most free because it's just me and
no editor.
And I usually, if you're reading something I wrote, I sat down and wrote it that day. I usually have to get like a fire lit under me about something. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm going to write about this. And then I bang it out. I used to write it on my lunch breaks at work. Uh-huh. So I knew that I would have you know, an hour, maybe less, to write it. And so I would just kind of like spit that all out, typos, all sorts of stuff. And I will go back and fix those things. But that's probably my most like free writing.
Yeah.
Because there I don't have to think about what anyone else thinks. So I'm a little looser. I don't host a comment section because I'm not going to host a forum for you to say my work is garbage.
Yeah.
So like I don't have to worry about comments from it, you know, whatever your friends are saying on Facebook, I'm not going to see that. You know, I have my Twitter set so that I don't see any of that. So that's probably that's my most like free, just saying things, like really just trying to make myself laugh. And then when I work on the books and when I work on stuff for the stage, I always have the audience.
It's different
first.
Energy for each thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I know like what the editor's looking for. And I know I love a tangent. I love an aside. I like to put a story within a story. And I have to think about how much of that I can get away with or how, you know. So there's lots of thinking going into things that other people are going to see because I'm super embarrassed by edits.
Really?
I get them and I'm great. I'll do everything the editor says, but it makes me want to fall over. I hate getting my work back. Like after you've picked it apart, I'm like, oh, why am I so dumb?
So you must have had, I'd love to hear, and we're running out of time, by the way. I have so many more questions, but we're going to have to wrap it up in the next 10 or so.
Okay.
But I have so many questions about your process. So you published first with Curbside Splendor, which is a small press, which is a world I'm really familiar with too. And then you went to a big publisher.
Yeah.
What was the editing process like? Like, how was it different?
At Curbside, I didn't have an editor.
Like, they were just like, you're smart and funny.
I don't know if that was it. They're just, we're real small.
Yeah.
And I didn't have one. And if someone is lucky enough to have a first edition, they have one with typos, I think.
Uh-huh.
And there's a story that didn't have an ending, I think, in the first run because I turned in the wrong draft.
Yeah.
So that
it happens.
That was scarier than doing it with a big publisher because like it's just sort of there's no filter between me and the world, right?
Yeah.
And I wasn't even thinking about the audience. I just couldn't believe they would let me do it. And then it was out in the world and I was like, oh, yeah, if you hate this book, then you really do hate me because it's just me. And then with We're Never Meeting, when it first came out on Vintage, it was like, the difference is I pitched a concept and I pitched a detailed outline with like what I wanted to do. I already had a few of the essays done, so they knew what they were getting and they knew what I wanted to do. And then working like closely with someone else was new to me, but also great to get that feedback. I mean, there were parts that she was just like, nah, this isn't going in. And I was like, okay, all right, that's not going in. Or like, this isn't good enough, or this doesn't fit. You know, there were a lot of like, this doesn't fit. And it was an interesting process for me to like pull back and have a bird's eye view and like watch someone else take this thing I made and like make it into a real book.
Yeah.
Rather than just like, here's a bunch of stuff I spitballed, you know, put a binding on it and
yeah, it's a process
and put it out there. So it was, I am the first to admit when I don't know something, I let the experts, you know, she is an editor and I am a nobody. So I was like, whatever you say, I'll do whatever you want.
It's a bit crushing to get the feedback, right?
Yeah. It's embarrassing. Only because I, like, all of the mistakes, I was like, I should have seen that. I knew I left that thread hanging. Or, you know, it was just, I am a person who is filled with shame. And so that's my own problem.
So you went into publishing, which is exactly. Yeah.
A shame-based industry. Yeah.
Let's talk for a moment about other people's publishing. I'm curious about what you're reading, what you like to read generally, and then what are you reading right now?
In general, I am a big popular fiction mm-hmm. person. So I'm friends with Rainbow Rowell, which is the only name I'm going to drop. And she, we were talking about, like, I don't know, some romance book. And I was like, no, I haven't read that. And she's like, oh, do you only read, you know, fancy stuff? And I was like, oh, no, I'll read a John Grisham or a Jodi Picoult. I have no shame about those things.
Yeah.
so I do. I read some literature. Uh-huh. But, you know, literature doesn't always, like, it's not propulsive. And I would rather fly through a damn thing than struggle through a thing that, like, takes a lot of energy and work. Like, I just want to read. I mean, that's why I write jokes. I just want to, like, just take me out of the world, you know, for however long. And now I'm about to drop a smart book. I am reading Friday Black, which is
next week on the Living Writer Show, by the way.
We'll have
Kwame Adjebrenya, who wrote Friday Black.
It's so good. And I love to read
a
book.
Smart.
I love to read a book where you're reading it and you're like, I could not come up with this. Or, like, how did he dream this up? How did he know this? I mean, it really, from the first sentence, I was pretty gobsmacked. I do the book recommendations for Marie Claire magazine. Mm-hmm. So I have to read a lot of stuff for them, and it's all literature. So really, in my downtime, I read, like, thrillers. I just read You by Carolyn Kepnes because I watched the show. It's a who killed the girl kind of thing. What else? And I just read My Body is a Book of Rules, which is like a memoir, it's not really by Alyssa Washuda. And it's not really, it's like a weird format, but it was very good. I really like that too.
Thanks for the
recommendation. Something for everyone.
Thank you. Holiday shopping. It's not done yet. We're almost out of time, and I've failed in my job of asking you about television, which I feel like I need to give you a chance to plug some television excitement related to your writing.
Well, so
tell us.
It's not officially announced, but it's done, so I can tell you that Comedy Central and I are going to turn my book Meaty into a TV show, hopefully. It's in development, which means I'm going to write a script. I've already started. I'm going to write a script, and we're going to come up with a show. I'm working with Abby Jacobson from Broad City.
Such a huge fan of hers.
Hopefully they will give us millions of dollars and let us make a show.
Yeah.
But when I say it to people that way, that feels realistic. Like, I have to write a thing that people will chance millions of dollars to produce. Yeah. So we'll see if I can do that.
And they very well might.
But if they don't, you'll know it's my fault.
Well, Abby Jacobson is a pretty great person to be working with.
She really is great. She has a book, too, that's very good.
She has a couple books.
Yeah. Her new essay book is really...
I want that one.
You gotta get it. It's really great.
I want her to come on Living Writers, too.
I will text her after this.
Okay.
Okay, I said I wasn't gonna drop any more names, but I can't help it. All my friends are famous. I'm just kidding. All my friends are, like, trash cans.
Did you just say trash cans? Yes. Some of your friends are out in the lobby.
Trash cans. Didn't you see me roll them in? Didn't you notice the smell?
Samantha Irby is our guest today on the Living Writers Show, WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Samantha is the author of We Are Never Meeting in Real Life and Meaty and the blog Bitches Gotta Eat. And we're so glad you joined us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
This was great.
See you next time.
Yes.
Okay.